Welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use for the last 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, October 19th. I'm asking if you could please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, phone numbers, whatever it takes so that you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, October 21st, at the Sand Hill Bluff in Wilder Ranch State Park. They'll start at 10 a.m., and because of parking at the site, they want you to meet at Wilder Ranch State Park and then carpool to the site, so please arrive before 9:50 in the morning. We will plan on leaving and heading to the project site by 10 a.m. To get to Wilder Ranch, take Highway 1 north out of Santa Cruz and continue north through the turnoff on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch. There is a sign indicating the turn. When you get to the kiosk, tell the person there you are volunteering and they will give you a parking pass. Meet the group at the interpretive sign at the bathrooms in the parking lot. For more information, contact Linda, the program leader, at 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041, or you could email her at redwoodrn@packbell.net. Or you could go to their webpage at cruisecnps.org. And logging has started at the Goose Timber Harvest Plan. And there's been a call for action from Oregon's Cascadia Forest Defenders. Logging has begun at the Goose Timber Sale in the Willamette National Forest, north of McKinsey Bridge and Highway 126. Cascadia Forest Defenders have maintained a tree sit protest inside the Goose Timber Sale since late May and have observed the first evidence of logging on Tuesday, October 17th. The Forest Defender tree sit was searched and extensively photographed Wednesday, October 18th, by Lane County Sheriff's deputies and Forest Service officers with a promise to see you tomorrow, says one Forest Defender. This is the first contact Cascadia Forest Defenders has had with law enforcement since the tree sit protest began 6 months ago. Cascadia Forest Defenders are making a general call to action to all activists and organizers in the Pacific Northwest to help them stop the Goose Timber Sale. Cascadia Forest Defenders will maintain a presence inside the Goose Timber Sale that will force Seneca Jones Timber Company and the U.S. Forest Service to abandon logging on public lands. Logging has begun on Forest Road 704 near the entrance to Frizzle Trail. CFD asks all participating volunteers, activists, and media to access Forest Road 705 at the intersection of Highway 126 and McKinsey River Drive. You can take the bus from Lane County Transit District, Route 91, at the intersection with Forest Road 705 at stop ID 09086 near milepost 49 on Highway 126. Cascadia Forest Defenders are committed to ending logging on all Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Forest Services public lands. In the spirit of legendary American naturalist E.O. Wilson, CFD wishes to keep half of Oregon wild, just as E.O. Wilson believed that half the earth must remain wild to maintain a livable biosphere. The Goose Timber Sale borders the H.G. Andrews Experimental Forest and has a high concentration of mountain springs that feed the McKenzie River. The McKinsey River is the primary water source for Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, and a crucial bull trout habitat. This action is not just about saving ancient forests or the McKinsey River. It's about preventing human extinction and all the suffering to come, says veteran activist Shannon Wilson. For more information, visit their webpage at forestdefensenow.com. That's forestdefensenow.com. And farther south, two Humboldt Redwood Company workers showed up at 10 a.m. Thursday, October 12th, and began to dismantle a blockade in the Matoll. The blockade was a tripod with one elongated pole that holds up a platform on one side and is being held up by rope tied between two trees on the other side, and there's a person sitting in the platform. Protesters pleaded with the workers to stop as it would endanger a person's life, and they just continued to take apart logs from the blockade. Four protesters then sat on top of the logs, and the Humboldt Redwood Company employees stopped dismantling the blockade. Protesters called into question Humboldt Redwood Company's certification by the Forest Stewardship Council. Then the Humboldt Redwood County workers got in their company vehicle and drove away. Blockaders have held this road since June of this year following a huge herbicide operation by Humboldt Redwood Company in unlogged primary forest. The blockade halted further logging and road construction. Humboldt Redwood Company says they have no intention to log for the rest of this year, yet the timber company just unveiled a new proposal to build a new road to circumvent the blockaders. The new road is plotted along a steep mountainside above an old-growth forest and would obliterate a very old, probably old-growth bay laurel tree and grove hugging the side of a huge bedrock outcrop. The company may even have plans to quarry the stone, as they admit surveying the site for such a quarry in 2014. The threat to the headwaters of the North Fork and the Mattole River and this iconic megalith will not go unchallenged. And turning to England, Bristol hunt saboteurs have disrupted two hunts for the price of one. And this story from Bristol hunt saboteurs is found on the Earth First Newswire. Saturday was an absolute result for the hunted wildlife. Our first port of call was an early morning cubbing meet at the Ledbury South near St. Margaret's in Herefordshire. We got to work trying to find the hunt, and their location was soon given away by the Terrier Boys. Thanks, lads. As soon as the hunt were in our sights, the game was over. Sabs got to work and immediately took control of the hounds, rendering the hunt useless. The first act of sabotage set the tone for the rest of the morning. We split into two groups, which meant we were completely on top of the hunt. Every time they attempted to hunt foxes, we stepped in and took control of the hounds using horns, voice calls, and our trusty gizmo, which is a pre-recorded track of hounds in cry played through a megaphone. Both foxes and hares were aided to safety by the Sabs, and it all became a bit of comical towards the end of the morning as the hounds spent more time with us than with the hunt. Absolutely blinding result, especially given the context. The Ledbury South were essentially the former riders and masters of the dissolved South Herefordshire hunt, who are currently at the center of a police investigation after being caught on camera feeding live fox cubs to hounds at their kennels last year, as reported on the Earth First Newswire, following the hounds and huntsmen of the equally distasteful Ledbury hunt. Next up, we were off on our second hunt of the day, the Severn Vale Beagles, after spotting Carr kennel watching them, and followed on to their meet in North Nibley near Dursley in Gloucestershire. When Sabs arrived shortly after 1 p.m., we found the hunt already out and setting up to draw a field in an attempt to put up and chase hare. As soon as our cameras were on them, they were on the phone and legging it, a sign of wrongdoing if there ever was one. We kept eyes on them as they did a little circuit, mopping up their followers on the way back to the meet. As our second vehicle arrived, they were boxing up the beagles and quickly scampered out of there. A long and tiring day for us, but a good one. And you can find out more at the Earth First Newswire. The struggle in Poland's Białowieża Forest continues. Anarchist comrade has been seriously assaulted by forest guards in this story from Insurrection News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Although the European Court of Justice have ordered the Polish government to stop cutting trees in the Białowieża, the logging continues. Activists from the Camp for the Forest, which consists of a diverse group of protesters, including anarchists, protest every day and try to stop heavy equipment such as harvesters and forwarders from working. On Tuesday, September 12th, a very high activity of harvesters and forwarders was discovered, trucks transporting lumber to the forest corners of the country, where due to their exceptionally low price, they are converted into pallets. The blockade during the peaceful picket stopped the logging and forced the machines to return to their base. Later, it turned out that many 100-year-old and spruces and oaks had been cut. This is also the area where two endangered species that are strictly protected in Poland, the Eurasian pygmy owl and the three-toed woodpecker, have been heard previously. On Wednesday, the September 13th, the situation repeated. Machines came back to finish their job. During the peaceful action, the Shtuzhba-Lezhna forest guards brutally attacked protesters. Protesters tried to stop the cut trees from being driven away. They ran to block the forwarders, but suddenly they were assaulted by members of the forest guards. One of the anarchist activists, Kauka, was knocked down and beaten by forest guards. As a result, he spent several hours in the hospital emergency department. The ambulance was called at his request. At the hospital, he had head x-rays, hand x-rays, and was placed on a drip. After a few hours, he was released with head and wrist injuries, the CT showing subcutaneous hematomas. About 10 o'clock, we entered the forest, passing a few guards blocking the entrance. We ran through the forest towards the place where the harvester and the forwarder, which was removing and storing cut trees to be loaded onto trucks and transported, were standing. At some point, I saw a gap between the guards, and as a result of the general confusion, and I decided to use it to reach the forwarder and clip to it. Half a meter from the machine, I was brutally knocked to the ground by two guards who acted almost like an American football match, knocking me down into the stacked tree trunks. I hit one of them with my head. Later, they jumped on me. At all costs, they wanted to take a tube that I had in my hand. At first, they dropped my camera so nothing could be recorded. One of the guards hit my head twice on a tree trunk. Another pressed his thumbs around my lower jaw and throat, causing pain, hoping that would force me to release the tube. They set levers on my fingers, hands, shoulders, and legs. One of them stood on my hand. All this took a few minutes. During this time, they did not respond to my request to stop. After a long time, their commander came up, who ordered them to put me on my feet and bring me my lost belongings, phone, camera, which I was not able to retrieve when I was knocked to the ground earlier. At my request, the ambulance was called, which took me to the hospital, said Kauka. But not only Kauka was a victim of the attack, others were handcuffed with a rope tied around trees, dragged along the ground, and sexist abuse was yelled at the women protesters, and on and on. This was not the first life-threatening situation. Previously, the forest guards cut off the rope on which Kauka was hanging from a tree about 10 meters high. Another time, the forwarder operator tried to run over activists when four of them tried to block him. When he did not stop, Kauka jumped on the forwarder's hood. This also did not stop him. He sped up and continued to drive, turning violently on the road, driving into branches and trying to shake Kauka off. After several hundred meters of this tour, Kauka managed to jump down to safety. Another participant of the protest had his finger cut after the forest guards tried to cut off the rope to which he was clipped. All this happened only in recent weeks. The forest guards are completely unprepared for such situations. They possess powers like the police, armed with telescopic batons, tear gas, and guns, but are unprepared to deal with peaceful protests. This threatens the health and lives of the protesters. It proves that the authorities are in a hurry to cut and remove the timber, which has led to an increased number of forest guards who have become more brutal and more ruthless. This may lead to a tragedy in the future. We do everything we can to stop the logging, organize blockades and protests, educate people. We do not act against locals. Our actions and the logging itself have resulted in more and more locals supporting us in our struggle. But the struggle is still going. We do not give up. The whole Bailuiza Forest, the National Park. And Oregon has just ordered the hunting and killing of four more wolves from the Harl Butte Pack. That doubles the number of wolves the state has killed from this pack. They started the year with 13 wolves, including three pups. If the state goes forward with this, fewer than half will remain, and some ranchers are insisting that the entire pack be wiped out. Together we stand with the wolves in Oregon, just like we've stood for wolves all over the country. With barely 100 wolves left in the entire state of Oregon, it's more urgent than ever. The Governor Kate Brown hears from as many people as possible that this is just plain wrong. We're stepping up our efforts, and we need you to do the same. Sign the Environmental Action Team. And you can get more information at environmental-action.org. That's environmental-action.org. And a Minnesota judge has allowed the necessity defense by climate activists in a oil pipeline protest. In this story by Philip McKenna of Inside Climate News. A judge in Minnesota has cleared the way for an unusual and potentially groundbreaking defense allowing climate activists to use the necessity defense of confronting the climate crisis as justification for temporarily shutting down two crude oil pipelines last year. Robert Tiffany, a district court judge in Clearwater County, Minnesota, ruled on October 11th that three activists who were arrested and charged with felonies last year can argue that they had violated the law in order to protect citizens from the impacts of global warming and that they had no legal alternative. It is extremely unusual for a court to allow presentation of the necessity defense by environmental protesters, said Michael Girard, a director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. It will be fascinating to see how this trial goes and how much evidence the court will allow. The ruling is only the third time a judge in the United States has allowed for such a defense in a climate case. The first case in Massachusetts in 2014 did not go to trial after the prosecutor dropped the charges. A judge allowed the necessity defense in a Washington state case in 2016, but then instructed jurors they could not acquit on necessity. Only a few courts have allowed presentation of the climate necessity defense, and until Friday, no judge in a jury trial in the United States had recognized the defense in writing. The Climate Defense Project, a legal nonprofit that provided pretrial briefing and is a part of the defendant's legal team, said in a statement. In the Minnesota case, Emily Johnson, Annette Clapstein, and Benjamin Joldersma are charged with felonies over the shutdown of two pipelines on October 11, 2016. The fourth defendant, Stephen Lipte, who filmed the pipeline shutdowns, is charged with two gross misdemeanors. Enbridge Incorporated, the Canadian company that owns and operates the two pipelines, said at the time of the shutdowns that the actions were reckless and dangerous and that the company would support the prosecution of all those involved, according to news reports. The use of a necessity defense is typically used not for protests, but for more clear-cut cases of individuals intentionally committing a crime to prevent imminent danger, such as breaking into a house where someone is being held hostage, Girard said. Political activists have, however, used the necessity defense in the past in opposition to issues including the Vietnam War, nuclear weapons, and abortion. The defense tactic is widely seen as an attempt to focus attention on controversial government policies by forcing jurors to pass judgment on the morality of such policies and of individuals' resistance to them. The pipeline shutdowns in Minnesota were part of a multi-state protest by the group Climate Direct Action to protest the flow of tar sands crude into the United States and to show solidarity with the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in North Dakota. I think it's a sensible ruling that will allow the jurors to take into consideration all the information that they really need to rule on this case properly, Marla Markham, director of the Climate Disobedience Center, said. Markham's group is collaborating with the defendants in the Minnesota case and other Valve Turner cases on trial strategy. Ken Ward, who shut down a pipeline in Washington State, was convicted of second-degree burglary in June and received 30 days of community service. Activists who shut down a pipeline in North Dakota were convicted of felony charges earlier this month and are awaiting sentences. Activists in Montana are still awaiting trial for similar acts. The case in Minnesota may center around whether the actions taken by the protesters shutting down valves on an active pipeline presented an equal or greater risk than that posed by climate change. You are getting close to threats to public health, welfare, and safety when you start actually damaging the infrastructure itself, Patrick Parentow, an environmental law professor at Vermont Law School, says. The equation here is, did the defendants take action appropriate to draw attention to the problem, or does the balance tip against them and in favor of protecting public health and safety? The prosecutor will probably put people on the stand who will say this is dangerous, Parentow said. Soon after the pipeline shutdowns last fall, Carl Weimer of the Pipeline Safety Trust, an industry watchdog, characterized the activity as a dangerous stunt, according to news reports. Markham said that in each case, pipeline operators were notified of valve closures several minutes before they occurred, so the companies could shut down the compressors that pump the oil through the pipes to safely shut down the pipelines. In his ruling, Judge Tiffany stated that Minnesota's standard for the necessity defense is high. To successfully assert the defense, a criminal defendant must show that the harm would have resulted from obeying the law would have significantly exceeded the harm actually caused by breaking the law. There was no legal alternative to breaking the law. The defendant was in danger of imminent physical harm, and there was a direct causal connection between breaking the law and preventing the harm. Gerard said the decision to allow a necessity defense may be part of a growing awareness in the courts of the risks of climate change, including recent rulings on coal leases and natural gas pipelines, that went in favor of closer scrutiny of environmental considerations. What we are seeing in some courts is that there is such a frustration at the failure of the executive and legislative branches of the government to act on climate change that some courts are willing to step in, he said. And a lawsuit has been launched to protect endangered rusty-patched bumblebees. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed a formal notice of intent to sue the Federal Highway Administration and the Illinois Department of Transportation for failing to prevent harm to the endangered rusty-patched bumblebee. In awarding the Endangered Species Act protection to the bee in March, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service acknowledged that all of the bee's remaining populations are important to its survival. The species has already declined by an estimated 91%, yet the agency recently signed off on a federal highway project in Illinois that will destroy known bee habitat. Federal and state officials just can't walk away from their legal obligation to protect the rusty-patched bumblebee, said Stephanie Parent, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. Like many Midwesterners, my childhood was filled with the buzzing of fuzzy bumblebees. It angers me that the agencies entrusted to protect this critically imperiled creature are refusing to do their jobs. Rusty-patched bumblebees are pollinators that are vital for healthy ecosystems and food security. They were once widely found across the upper Midwest and Northeast, but their numbers have plummeted dramatically since the 1990s, largely because of habitat destruction. They are the only mainland U.S. bee species to obtain federal protection and were sighted as recently in August in undeveloped land along the Fox River, slated to be bisected by the Longmeadow Parkway and its toll bridge. Rather than acknowledge the bee's presence and formally consult on the highway project's potential harm to the bee as the law requires, the agencies conducted a cursory habitat survey only within the immediate footprint of the bridge that failed to fully assess threats to the bee. The Endangered Species Act is 99% effective at protecting our most imperiled wildlife, but it can only work when its mandates are followed, said Parent. Since these agencies have ignored the bee's presence, we've got no choice but to take legal action to force officials to protect these important little animals. If the agencies do not agree to enter into formal consultation within 60 days, the center plans to sue them for violations of the Endangered Species Act. And the Cascades frog is closer to California Endangered Species Act protection. In response to a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity, the California Fish and Game Commission has designated the Cascades frog as a candidate for protection under the state's Endangered Species Act. Cascade frogs are no longer found in most of the mountain lakes and streams of Northern California where they were once common, primarily due to disease and predation from introduced fish. Cascades frogs have completely disappeared from Lassen Volcanic National Park. Cascade frogs are tough little amphibians, but they desperately need our help to survive the dramatic habitat changes occurring in Northern California, said Jeff Miller of the Center for Biological Diversity. Protecting these frogs under the California Endangered Species Act should spur habitat restoration measures, invasive species control, and reintroduction of frogs to their former habitats. As a candidate species, the Cascades frog will receive all the protections of the state-listed species for a year while the commission decides whether to provide permanent endangered species protection. And the seal of Bergen County, New Jersey, greets folks not only as they enter the Justice Center, but almost every room inside the giant white building in the middle of Hackensack, New Jersey. The seal features what is supposed to be a native person, peace pipe in hand, greeting what looks like a pilgrim as an eagle flies overhead and a boat sits peacefully in the water. The picture was a lie 334 years ago when it was made and remains a lie today. It represents a world that exists solely in the mind of old white people, similar to the concept that anyone actually gets justice at the Justice Center. Inside the courthouse in room 426, the Ramapo Lenape Nation are facing off against the township of Mawa in a case that is ostensibly about zoning violations, but in reality carries hundreds of years of racist history with it. In the antiquated courtroom, the Lenapes had about 20 supporters dressed in red. They varied in age from teenagers to retired folks and were from many different backgrounds. Meanwhile, sitting on the side of the city were homeowners from the Ramapo Polo Club, a housing development that encroaches on a small plot of land still owned by the Lenape. The homeowners were all white and all old, just like the judge, and just like the pictures of the retired judges on the wall. The alleged zoning violations occurred on a small piece of land a few hundred yards away from the houses of the Polo Club, being used by the Split Rock Sweetwater Prayer Camp, a gathering of water protectors who are gearing up to fight against the Pilgrim Pipeline. There's been a protest present since last October, that means 2016, when some Ramapo Lenape folks put up a teepee obtained at Standing Rock in solidarity with the North Dakota camp, and since the beginning, angry residents of the Polo Club and local officials have been pushing back. The Lenape tribe has received over 40 tickets of zoning violations at the Split Rock Sweetwater Prayer Camp, all of which they are fighting because, in their experiences, the township has certain standards for tribe members and different standards for non-tribe members. The township of the Mawe claims that the teepees, tents, yurts, some solar panels, and a sweat lodge all violate local ordinances because they are permanent structures which require permits. In reality, none of these are permits, as they can all be taken down in an hour's time. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update today. The Earth First Update is presented on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org every Thursday at 9 p.m. You can hear a rebroadcast of the show Fridays at 3 p.m. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You could listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. Or you could go to radioforall.net where you can listen online or download this program at any time. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of the Earth First Radio Network and is produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. And please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.